So, we are here. It's been a while. It's been over a year since we last did this show format, but we are back. We are in Comics on Trial, the show that pits two members of the Comics in Motion family in a geek battle. Each week, well, we were quite optimistic there. Each week, one person will defend an unpopular opinion and the other, representing the common consensus, will prosecute the case in the court of public opinion. Today, we are putting Indiana Jones, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull in the dock and representing the prosecution. I've done this. I'm so not used to doing this, like reading directly from a script. Yeah. Like, I'm used to, I've just got notes of, like, keywords, and I should have abbreviated it for myself, but that's how long it's been with the show. And that's why I'm a new judge, friends. I haven't done this. People have heard me on the show on both the defense. I defended a defense and attack. So I defended Phantom Menace against Scott and won, but then I prosecuted against Rise of Skywalker against Tony and lost. That my now fiance chose against me. Outrage. People thought she was going to be biased towards me, and it didn't.
I did Phantom Menace and Scott did Rise of Skywalker.
Oh, yes. Right, sorry. That was it. No, and I did. What was it? I did something. Was it Rise of Skywalker? Was that the only Comics on Trial I've been on?
I think
no,
so.
No, we did Phantom Menace, you and I. Yeah. And then you and he did Skywalker. Right?
Yep.
I thought I did both. Yeah, but you and I did a Rise of Skywalker, Tony, because you defended it. You defended Rise of Skywalker.
Oh, why did I think I did? I thought I did Phantom.
And then I did Phantom Menace with Scott because Scott was prosecuting against me, and I won on that one. So now I'm the judge. And it's funny that the two people I've been against in the Comics on Trial, I'm now. So I'm as impartial as we get. Impartial.
And George, and the common factor, George Lucas.
Well, yeah, exactly. So it's very, very apt. Very apt. And even yeah. Harrison Ford as well. Yeah, even yes. I wouldn't say that. But obviously, the intros haven't gone exactly how they would in the script, but we're done away with that. It's all part of the fun. So I am here, being the judge, so I should be quiet for most of this, with Scott Weatherly of the 20th Century Geek, our stories out of time and space. How are you doing, good sir? And you are prosecuting Indiana Jones, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. So tell us how you are, and tell us just in brief what your kind of opening statement is, in a way.
Okay, yeah, I'm good, thank you. Yeah. As we were just saying, the hay fever has been kicking my butt a little bit, but I'm through it and I'm ready to take on this prosecution. As you say, 20th Century Geek, a little bit on hiatus, but Stories Out of Time and Space going strong, working our way through all the episodes of Black Mirror, me and Julian, which has been fascinating, good stories. Some controversial opinions come in on that one. But yeah, Indiana Jones and Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. I watched this in cinemas in Las Vegas. So I was in Vegas for a wedding and I went and sort of watched this on my own. And I'm a massive Indiana Jones fan. There's a photo of me in a homemade fancy dress as a child going to a kid's party. And I will say this, it wasn't a kid's fancy dress party. I just chose to go as Indiana Jones. I was young enough or old enough to see Last Crusade in the cinema. So this was a big thing. And I went in, it wasn't very busy. There was me and there was this other guy sitting close, and he was about my age. And we were both like, oh, it's exciting stuff. And when it was done, he looked at me and he just rolled his eyes, sighed and walked out. And I don't think I was feeling that bad, but there was that level of disappointment. I'd waited 20 years to return to this story and then to have this story and this film be presented to me. And I feel that it's that disappointment. I mean, I'm going to vent, and I'm going to bring some of the receipts on that. Really, that's where I'm coming from today.
I see. And so, is your point? Are you trying to make, like, what's your kind of key argument? In a sense, is it that Indiana Jones: Kingdom of the Crystal Skull is the, obviously, I'll ask for Tony.
It's the worst of the four. It's, well, yeah, we've got right. Dial of Destiny coming, but I believe it's the worst of the Indiana Jones films.
Okay.
But I also want to prosecute on the fact that it doesn't hold true to the spirit of the Indiana Jones movies.
Okay, interesting point. So Tony, you then, how are you, good sir? And then tell us, Indiana Jones, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, your thoughts and opening statement.
Sure, so hello, thank you for doing this. I appreciate you guys jumping on. Yeah, so for my, one, not my earliest memory, my earliest memory doesn't involve Harrison Ford and my cousin Noom, seeing the original Star Wars in the movie theater at the drive-in when I was four, but this Raiders of the Lost Ark is the movie I saw the most in theaters. Every Tuesday for an entire summer, my auntie took us to the movies to see Raiders of the Lost Ark because it was a dollar. Oh, and wow. So my sister and my cousin saw something different each Tuesday, and Noom and I saw this. Saw Raiders. And so I too won a Halloween costume, Mr. Weatherly, wearing this hat right
Which
here.
is
None of that.
phenomenal. I love
It's
it.
such a cool hat. It
And
is.
so this is my grandpa's hat, and I tried to put it on over the thing. It's about 100 and some years old. It was handmade in Benton Harbor, Michigan. I wore this hat. I had like a little wooden machete because it was during that I dressed up for him, obviously, during Temple. And as an adult, I also dressed as Indiana Jones when I had kids. So this is a, same hat, different jacket, obviously, because
You grew up.
but I had a whip and everything as a kid. Like I would like whip and swing and do everything. So my argument is, number one, that it is not the worst of the four films, and that number two, it is exactly what it's supposed to be 20 years later, because Indiana Jones is 20 years older. The world is 20. It's the 50s. It's the late 50s instead of the late 30s. So we've gone through World War II. And so he would change, the world would change, obviously, without. And obviously, I mean, clearly, having Sean Connery in the third film, there's a big part of that. So I'm sure that'll come up. But so of course, it felt a little different. But I do understand where it was going. So I'm just here to say I love it. I think it's fun. And I disagree that it is that it, I think it has gotten a bum rap, and so I'm here to try to prove that.
Can I start at one point? I'm not going to rebuke. I am actually just curious.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
What do you feel is then the weakest of the indie movies?
Temple.
Okay, yeah, I'm okay. That's the I believe the second. I
I
think
think
there's
if you were about to say Last Crusade, I think I would come for
a. I'd
you.
have
No, that's
reached.
the best.
I'd have reached through the cameras and
Yeah.
started killing
No.
people.
I think like if
Last
people say
Crusade
Raiders is their
is.
favorite, that's acceptable to me. But for
And I
me,
get
Last
there.
Crusade is
No, Last
absolutely.
Crusade
Yes,
is perfection.
but I will
Yeah, I mean
say
that
it
is the
is.
perfect. Like you don't even have to have seen anything else.
Yeah.
Last Crusade is the most Spielbergian
Yes. Oh, yeah.
movie. That's the one that I mean he doesn't get writing credit for any of these four films, but that is the one where clearly he was like, look, if we're gonna do a third one, get out of my way.
Yes.
George, I love you, brother, but get out of the way. And that is, I believe, what happened in the third one.
Yeah, I agree. So with these films, I've got a couple of just notes about it, and I think the years of release will be a factor in some of the discussions here. So just in brief, before we kind of delve into the minutiae of these films and we present certain elements. So we've got Raiders of the Lost Ark was out 1981, then 3 years
Year I was
later.
born.
Nice, very nice. So yeah, 81, and then 3 years on from that was Temple of Doom in 1984. Then 5 years on from that was The Last Crusade in 1989. Then 19 years after that is Kingdom of the Crystal Skull in 2008, and then with Dial of Destiny coming out, that's 15 years difference in 2023. So 3, 5, 19, 15 is the kind of the gaps between them. And obviously, this is the end. We had a trilogy that finished with Last Crusade, which we've all just agreed is absolutely phenomenal, and in my opinion, the best indie film. Incredible. And I myself, for a bit of research for this, I hadn't seen the Indiana Jones films for a while, years, in fact. Before, me and Megan haven't watched them together, so we just decided on a whim. She was actually like, "I really fancy watching Raiders of the Lost Ark," so we did. And then with this coming up, we're like, "Oh, cool, we have a chance to watch the others." And when I was younger, I wasn't as into it. So with you two both being super into Indiana Jones, my dad was. He loved Harrison Ford, so Han Solo and Indy was his two go-tos. But like, I enjoyed Indy. I liked it, but it didn't quite connect with me because I've always been much more of a sci-fi head. You wouldn't know anything about that, Scott. You don't like sci-fi, so it's
Yeah.
but yeah,
I'm all
it
about the courtroom dramas. That's my thing.
That's
Yeah,
what you're
that's
known for.
stories out of Dick Wolf's Law and Order is next. That's what he's doing. Because I'm sure
Yeah.
Julian would love those. That would be like a surefire way to make him jump in that volcano on his island is to have him have to do that.
Oh man, but yeah, so I with Indy I didn't I liked it, but I didn't love it. I didn't quite get into it, and I especially really disliked Temple of Doom when I was younger. And then I will not say anything about my well, no, I'll say I've come into this very neutral. I've watched them all four of them, and I've taken a few notes and things, and I think, yeah, the first and third one heads and shoulders above the rest, but the second and fourth one I'm kind of like this with them, depending on situations. And I know that both of you are going to come up with very interesting points that I've certainly not considered. And so it's going to be very interesting because I am genuinely completely unbiased, since I don't have a closeness to indie. So when Kingdom came out, I was like, cool, another Indiana Jones film, sure. But when I did watch the cinema, I wasn't as much of a fan. I did have a bit of a bad taste in my mouth, but yeah, I'm kind of neutralish now. So I'm really interested to see where we go from here. And I haven't really spoken about Indiana Jones, which is quite atrocious because it's Lucasfilm, as you guys have pointed out and things. So it's very exciting to get into this. So We will start with Tony on this one, just to start with. So, Tony, where do you want to begin? Should we compare the first three to the fourth, or do you have a specific point in mind you want to kind of jump off with?
Well, I think it's impossible not to, but I'm not here. Mm-hmm. I am here to definitely say Crystal Skull is better than Temple, and that mm-hmm. is, and that can be part of my argument. But my reason to defend Crystal Skull is I think it was unfairly maligned. I think it is one of those things that it couldn't help it. People kind of felt like it was a cover band of its own thing. Mm-hmm. I do think I personally believe there was some Shia LaBeouf backlash because this was kind of at the height of his douchiness when this came out. Like, he filmed it and he was like in Transformers, he was everywhere. And then people found out he was like a method actor and he scared that woman who was Alice Wachowski. I can't think of her first name, on the set of their bootlegger movie because he wouldn't get out of character. And it was like, he's kind of a creep and weirdo. And so I think that hurt. But I think there was this idea that it was going to be perfect. And I put the blame a little bit at George Lucas superfan Ernest Cline's feet as well, because in Ready Player One, the book, which had come out before this, he had already poisoned the well by telling everyone that anything after the original trilogy was going to suck. And it was only a rumor at the time that there would be more.
So I only read Ready Player One when the film came out. So I'm not I wasn't poisoned before.
totally fair. Okay, that's totally fair. But I do think that was kind of, so that's good to know. But I do think that there was just this idea that because the third one was perfect, everyone's like, well, why ruin it? But to me, that means that after you did, From Russia with Love, you should stop doing James Bond movies because it's the best Sean Connery movie. So we should just stop. That's silly to say. Like, when Sean Connery got too old, we kept making James Bond films. And Indiana Jones is Steven Spielberg's James Bond movie. He wanted to do Bond and they wouldn't let him. So he did this. So to me, there's not. It's just like anything else. I think it was doomed to fail because of that. And I my concern in this, we're releasing this on Dial of Destiny Day, is that people are going to go into Dial. Again, now it's been 15 years. Yeah. You acknowledge the point. So I just think it, I don't think it had the chance, because in everybody's mind, the last one was so good that they immediately compared it. But I'm here to say it is on par with the other three films. We will just agree that Last Crusade is perfect, but it's on par with those. And I think it does the things that Indiana Jones needs to do in 1957.
So your point is generally you want this film not to be looked at like, this is the Indiana Jones trilogy that's great, and then there's that one. You want it to be, here's the four great Indiana Jones films. That's kind
correct.
Of...
correct. It is right. Part of
you want it to
series.
Be a quadrilogy, not a trilogy in another one.
That's exactly correct. I don't. Right. I'm not a believer that anything after... same with the... like, it was like, oh, there's only one Matrix movie and those other ones aren't... No, sorry. That's the films they wanted to make. You can dislike them, but to pretend they don't exist. And I know Scott's not here to say Crystal Skull doesn't exist. But you know, that is an argument that people make. Yeah. And so I'm here to say it is a very good film that deserves its place.
I will go on that. I will say that, you know, I know there's some bits I want to agree and I'll disagree as well, but you're right. I think, you know, it's an Indiana Jones film. It exists in the franchise, you know. Unfortunately, like, A Good Day to Die Hard is a part of the Die Hard franchise. It's like, you know, Terminator Genesis is part of the Terminator franchise. And Mike...
are you just going to name Jai Courtney films? Is that what you're...
I appear to be, yeah. And the Caravan of Courage is a part of the Star Wars. You can't deny these things. What I would say is, though, just to sort of back up... firstly, I have no problem with Shia LaBeouf in this film. And actually, I've recently gone back and watched some of the Transformers films. Mm. And having watched this... and I watched, there's a film called Disturbia.
He did as well.
I watched that. I find that young Shia LaBeouf is actually very good. I think he is a great actor. I think he's a great presence. I think he works as relatively well as Mutt Williams in this. So I'm not going to bash Shia LaBeouf. I actually think I understand what you're saying. I do feel that there was that in the zeitgeist at the time. For me, though, what I'm going to counter this. So there's a couple of things that I find interesting about this film's placement in history or in its time. And again, not so much the chronology of in the Indiana Jones timeline. And I'm happy that they went into the 50s and didn't try and sort of lie about his age and have him in the 40s or something like that. Like, having him in the 50s, I'm fine with that. Acknowledging his age and his legacy sequels, all good. The problem I have is actually more about the production of the film, and that's what I mean, its place in history. What I see when I remember watching the trailer for this, and one of the, you know, we'll get into it, and there's a couple of things, but there's an entire sequence in the jungle in this film that includes like big tanks and tree chopping things and monkey swinging and a bunch of other things. And all I could think of when I saw that, and it's noted in the trailer, was this is a post Pirates of the Caribbean film. That's what this is. And that's where they've taken Indy, and that's why Shia's here, because Indy can't do those swashbuckling, you know, Johnny Depp sort of Errol Flynn-esque kind of adventure-y things. He's too old, so we need a younger person to do those. And that's where I was seeing it as that sort of thing. Is when I'm saying it doesn't feel of a piece, is there are scenes in this film. So if you do go back, and again, we, you know, we've said about the three, and I agree with Temple being on par for similar reasons. You've got the young sidekick, you have the ridiculous moments, whether it be the mine chase or the jungle chase, those sorts of things. But in all those films, you have exterior shots where you'll go, bloody hell, that looks good. You know, you have the most iconic shot from Raiders where there you have the sun setting down behind them, and you have all the sort of the Egyptian workmen working and singing along, you know, and you have this sort of indie sort of silhouetted on that hill. But then you have the whole desert thing, and you have all the outdoor sets, and it's incredibly sort of tactile and real. And, you know, all the stunts look real, and you think, Jesus, like someone must have been bruised to fuck to make that thing. And the same with Temple, you have these exterior shots, they ride elephants, they have all these things. It feels like it exists in a real world. And then you have, again, the same with Last Crusade. You know, they go to Venice, they have the boat chase, they have all these other things, they go to all over the place, right? And then the tank chase at the end, which is possibly one of my favourite sequences in history of cinema, is just amazing. And ends with that moment, I think, was it? Yeah, you put it on there, didn't you, Tony, of how the emotional scene of the sort of the tank goes over, then they see the hat, and it's...
Jack did, but it is, yeah, it is spot on. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's perfect. But this film, apart from one scene, like, it never feels that scale. They go places, but because of the CGI use, I'm not bashing the use of CGI, because I think, you know, it's a thing, or even the quality, but it brings a different feel. And I felt this is a post-Star Wars sequel, post-Star Wars prequel, post-Caribbean, Pirates of the Caribbean film. And there are several scenes, like where they first come across, they're in Peru, and they have that, the burial thing, and they have the Peruvian warrior ninja men, which is kind of cool. But that set feels like a set. And then they have another bit, and when they actually go into the jungle, I'm like, it feels like a set. Like, there's never anything like expansive. And for such a big film, it feels kind of small throughout. And so when I say of the same spirit of Indy, this one I want to clarify, when I say the spirit of Indiana Jones, I mean this doesn't have that tactile, massive, great vista, you know, sort of practical effect kind of spectacle that I'm looking for when it comes to an Indiana Jones film.
Yeah, that sense of adventure almost. The it feels enclosed in a way.
It does. Sorry, this, yeah, very much so. Yeah.
I hear that. I do, but I do think too. I mean, that is true. But I mean, like Temple, most of Temple, 50% of it takes place underground.
Yeah, but that's fun. But it feels expansive though. Those sets. I mean, that set of the Kali set. You know, with the sort of like the big skull and I know there's a lot of matte painting going on in that. You can see some of it. It still feels big, and it doesn't feel like much like a set. But this feels like it's filmed inside, to me at least. Like, and especially that scene with the ninjas. They're not ninjas. You know what I mean?
No, I know. I do. I know. Because it was every time you see that scene, you're like, have you guys always been in there? Did you get like a call? You got to show up because people are
the
here.
Buzzer
like,
goes. Yeah, this pager goes. What?
Oh,
we're on.
Right, oh, we got to go hide in the thing, and we got to. It's got to be worth it because we're gonna break out, and it's gonna look cool as fuck. I hear what you're saying. I do think that, but I do think that's. I mean, same goes with Spielberg. I mean, it's a Spielbergian thing. You know, I mean, when you think back, I mean, he didn't use a real shark, everybody, for Jaws, in case you were worried. I know. I'm sorry to be the, but. He did, there is, you know, like he did everything he could do, right? You know, he to build the thing to make it look real, and that poor woman, oh my God, like she never got paid enough. I hope in like in residuals, that woman got all the money from the opening shot of
She Jaws. Got compensation, I believe, later on. So.
Good, good.
Mike doesn't know what we're saying, by the way, do you?
Have you not seen Jaws, Mike?
Seen what?
Jaws.
Oh, no, I've seen Jaws, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Which opening part?
So the woman that goes into the sea, that does the skinny dipping in the opening sequence.
Yeah.
They couldn't film this, like they couldn't show the shark, so they strapped her into a harness and then basically hoofed her around the sea for like several takes.
And she get quite bruised and stuff, quite injured.
It gave her back problems. I think she fractured her hip.
Yeah, I have heard about that. I thought you were talking about in Temple of Doom when the main actress gets covered in all those bugs, and those are real bugs.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
she had to be sedated to actually deal with that.
Yes,
that's his own wife. So in that case, Spielberg's wife did that. Scene.
Oh, is that?
He's married to Kate Capshaw.
Right. Yeah, they got divorced later, though. Maybe because of that.
That's a start.
But
it became a Spielberg king.
I hear what you're saying, but I do. Yes, yeah. I do think though that is a progression of Spielberg, though, because when you watch, what he did. Obviously, the dinosaurs aren't real in Jurassic Park either. But it is what he does. He's always trying to push the next thing. So to him, I get what you're saying, making this seem like it's too, because you're right, it is post, I mean, Lucas, this is still Lucas Films. It's, you know, Lucas Films make the special effects here, but it's still Spielberg's final say. So while I hear that, I also just feel like it's just a progression of what he's done in his career when he still does these big films. Even in his version of West Side Story, there's some CGI and there's some, and you can see like stuff that could have been all done practically. There's no reason that had to be. So I just think it's him as a filmmaker saying like, well, what can I do now that I've got like the original budget? Like they doubled the budget for this movie from the previous movie. And part of that is inflation, of course, $1989 dollars and $2008 dollars, but it's like a double budget. So he's like, what can I get away with? And generally you think if I've got a bigger budget, that means I can do more practical effects, a la what Tom Cruise does. But Spielberg is saying I'm not. While Harrison loves to do his own stunts, and I know it's always him on the horse. Mm-hmm. But you're also like, listen, man, I'm not gonna. You can't. We're not doing this. You know, and these monkeys aren't real. So, I hear that, but I just think it's part of like Spielberg's progression. As a director. Yeah, we'll see what it does without.
But progression does. Yeah, just because it's progression doesn't mean it's good, and that's the problem. You know, I understand that, and I do, and I appreciate what you're saying about the advances of technology. I mean, this came out the same year as Iron Man. You know, like the advances and Dark Knight, and like so the uses of CGI and stuff and technology in these films is warranted. Like I've just watched Avatar: The Way of Water not too long ago, so you know it's paved the way. It's been part of that. It's still that closed inness, though, that it feels, you know, map paintings, the ending sequence where they sort of get up onto the ruins and the ground starts spinning around. I'm like, it looks like Indy and that are looking at a screen. It's like, you know, okay, like I've seen map paintings and maybe it's because I've got that thing about the Uncanny Valley. Like I'll still watch like a Ray Harryhausen thing and go, that's amazing, you know. And then I'll watch a CGI that will look just as sort of shonky and go, well, that's awful. But like, I'm snobbish in that way. But that's my feel.
I hear that. And again, I guess to me, maybe that's just a preference thing. I mean, I don't feel like it took me out of it because again, time and place. I mean, Mike gave us the dates and you're right. It is just, it's just kind of like, I mean, you know, I didn't think Spielberg's third dinosaur movie was any good, but he was definitely trying something different. You know what I mean? And I don't think you can never blame Spielberg. You can never say Spielberg, you're doing the same shit over and over. I mean, you're always going to talk about fathers and sons. That's a thing you're always going to do. There's no doubt about
it. I want to get onto that as well.
I'd say with the location point, I think as we get further on in this, I will not be so clear with points allocation because I don't want it to be very clear exactly who I'm choosing and stuff like that. But I will say just on this specific part, I will concede with Scott because I think that thinking about it, especially as post Pirates of the Caribbean is such a great way of putting it, the scenes where they are swinging in that jungle, it doesn't look like a jungle at all. It looks like green. It just looks like, ignore the outside stuff, focus on the swinging and the monkeys and the action and the shooty stuff. So I'm thinking about when you say about the shots, especially in Raiders and Last Crusade and things, there are some of those points where you really do feel that. And again, with Temple of Doom, there are a lot of scenes that feel inside, but yeah, they don't really feel like a set. I kind of compared in my mind the Temple of where they do the Kali Ma stuff. For me, that almost felt like the Goonies style when they're in those caves. I was like, that feels like a really big, long cave. Whereas with the part of the end of Kingdom, I was like, yeah, this just it feels like staring at a screen, which I do get is technology. And it's one of the arguments that I've both gone on and defended the prequels about, obviously, which obviously hugely impacted these films. Yeah. So it's one of those interesting things. So I completely get both sides. But thinking about this film, because of that age gap, it is in that weird time because sort of, you know, back in the 80s and things like that, they didn't generally use CGI too much, you find, because it wasn't strong enough. And now we're post-2000s, it really does come in more. So do we want to move on to the father and son element? Is that what we're both ready to go on?
I believe so. I'm okay. Happy to do that. Yeah.
Fantastic. So I think I started with Tony last time, didn't I? So it's time for... So Scott, go ahead. With father and sons, what are your sort of opinions on Mutt? And I'm interested if you guys have any comparisons with Short Round or thoughts.
Oh, just I do. Yeah, okay, this brilliant. Boy does... This film does my boy Shorty like Short Round dirty, and it's you know, yeah, no. One thing is obviously that you say about Spielberg being the whole doing the whole father and sons, and it's a repeat trope that he's done, you know. And you can go back to Temple. I mean, the relationship between Indy and Short Round, you know, even his like surrogate father and stuff. And what's interesting is obviously Temple in timeline is a prequel to Raiders, so it happens a year before Raiders. So there's that question of like, what the hell happened to Short Round? I'm going to do a mic, and I've berated you a number of times for this mic, and so
I was going to come out with it, but it's a funny that you've done it. Please show it.
Yeah. So in canon, there is a comic. I hate saying it, where it tells you what happened to Short Round, and the fact that like Indy put him through school, and then he went off and actually became an adventurer of his own, and there's a sort of thing. So. That's sort of like, and it's not the movie canon, I agree, but it's sort of accepted as sort of like that's what happened to him. But you accept that, like, you know, Indy is not the greatest individual. Like, he's a bit of a wanderer. Like, he doesn't sit still for long. So he got rid of that. But then you have the father and son relationship between him and his dad in Last Crusade. And it's touching, like, you know, him and Sean Connery sort of like, you know, when you find out he was an absentee father because of the death of his mother and his obsession with the Grail, and he sort of says, you know, I was a great father. I taught you self-reliance. And you get all that scene and stuff. It's fantastic. But it comes to that resolution at the end. It's sort of like, you know, he calls him Indy, you know, and he acknowledges, you know, he wouldn't even take his father's name. He'd rather be named for the dog. After Indiana Jones, Indy comes from the dog. So you get to this film. And I understand why, you know, why Connery can't be in it and stuff and fine, like, you know, they're supposed to have aged out. And the fact that, like, I think Connery's only, like, 7 or 8 years actually older than Harrison Ford. So they'd be like, it just wouldn't work.
He opted out. They threw all the money at him.
Oh, did they?
I'm retired. When I said I was retired, yeah. I've got all the money. Yeah.
I'm busy slapping older women. So he didn't come up. But you have this thing. So I like these ideas that they're doing it, right? So, but it becomes a little bit on the nose for me. So you've gone, oh, absentee father and son, resolution at the end of Last Crusade. And then you get to the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, and it's like, absentee father and son. He calls himself Mutt. So he's not, you know, he doesn't take his given name. He's naming himself after, not a dog name, but the dog, as in Mutt.
I only just got that. Nice.
Yeah. And again, you go through this whole thing of like father and son, and, you know, I kind of like the relationship, but then went to find out that the reason he's an absentee father is that Marion Ravenwood decided not to tell him he had a son. And I'm like, again, okay, that's sort of like just a bit of a dick move. It's fine, you know, when we'll get to that sort of thing, but it seems so treading that same territory. And I understand, like, you know, oh, we're going to swap it round because it's sort of like, you know, generations, and he's now going to be a greaser and all this other stuff. But I'm like, you said like Spielberg, or, you know, you can't accuse him of ever doing the same thing. Yeah, you can, because like we've sort of done this twice before. And the thing is, like, I think this would have been more interesting if they had have had like Mutt actually be Short Round, and him coming back and being like, you picked me up off the street. You sort of, you know, you took me on these adventures, and then you cast me off to this school, and then what? Like, that's it, you know. And the fact that, like, maybe he then went and sought out Marion or something, but it just feels like it feels almost cheap. Do you know what I mean? To have, like, there's this character we've never told you about before, and now we're gonna have this whole thing, and I'm like, oh, but you've got a character that could do this in your canon. I don't understand why we're doing this. And so it does feel like treading over old ground, and but doing it in almost like a lazy way because they want to do the legacy sequel. So, yeah.
Okay.
I'll put that up. Tony?
Yeah, go on then.
Yeah, no, sure. I hear that. I hear everything you're saying. So a couple of points. So yes, it is. I mean, the Spielberg's thing that he definitely comes back to, even in his last movie, The Fabelmans, it's just about fathers and sons and parents and, you know, and mothers and families, his jam. So that is always going to be in every Spielbergian thing. Even in Jaws, you know, there's like, there's fraught relationships. Mm. That's always his jam. The only thing is like Duel, because you don't know anything about anybody, right? It's just, you're just being in a car. That's a banger of a movie, by the way. Anyway, so, he, I hear that, but my argument is, if you go in chronological order, not in release order, yeah. Indiana Jones, like the first one is obviously Raiders, but then when you go back and do the prequel to Temple of Doom, that one might as well be called Indiana Jones and the Child Endangerment. That's all that is. It's like him endangering the child. You know, that's what it is. And then, yeah. And then, so when you think about it in chronological order, then the next one, when we meet him, he's now without Shorty, and there's this lack of thing. And as he's trying to reconnect to Marion, there's this idea, well, maybe there could be something. And I don't, you know, and then when we get to the next one, we know Marion, no Mutt, and it's just a few years later. So we know he's left Willie Scott behind, he's left Short Round behind, he's now left Marion Ravenwood behind. And I appreciate the third one. The romantic thing, he's much more James Bond in that one, right? It's just like, I was the next man, Dad. And so there's that whole scene. But Indiana Jones is not a great guy. Just like James Bond is not a great guy. They're like cool as fuck. And you're like, yeah, but they're not good people. Like, we love them, but like, maybe Indiana Jones is a serial killer. And I understand, and I said this to Jack, I was like, I'm rewatching these. And he's like, oh, but it's the thuggies and it's Nazis, so it's fine. I'm like, well, there's a lot of collateral damage here. And Indiana Jones is not, he is a hugely flawed, awful person. And who knows that better than maybe the person that he had his first relationship with when she was still a teenager and he was an adult in graduate school. So the fact that he stands Marion up right before their wedding and she's already knocked up and she's already been dumped by him before, that is a once bitten, twice shy thing. So in my mind, Marion's being the best mom she can by finding Mutt a dad. She still names him Henry, but by finding him a dad who is stable. She needs stable. She was a teenager. She got fucked over by this guy. Then they have this grand adventure. They travel the world. Everything is great. He always treats her as an equal, and you see that in full respect in this, when he's like, they weren't you, honey. And when Mutt's like, don't let my mom do whatever, he's like, oh, grow up, kid. She can handle herself. So there's all that, like, you can see his growth as a person in this film. Like, it's Indiana Jones and the self-realization is the name of this one. Whereas Marion, I get that you're saying Marion's a dick, but I just say,
not that she's a dick, like, it's a bit of a dick move.
It's a huge dick move. There's no doubt about that, but she's protecting her son. Now all of a sudden she's like, wait a minute, she might not have even known she was pregnant. And then he leaves her at the altar where she's going to like call him up and be like, oh, by the way, let's try to make this work. She's like, okay, dude, you screwed me over when I was a kid. And I, you know, you were a kid. I was a child and you knew better and all that whole line from the
first
movie.
And it's the 30s or 40s as well. Let's not forget.
Correct.
So communication is actually really difficult.
Correct.
That's a fair point. Yeah, yeah.
So she's like in her, you know, when the first time she gets burned, she's like probably 16 and he's like 22, 23. And now it's, you know, he's in his 30s and she's in her late 20s. And she's like, listen, man, I can't keep doing this. And so that's my feeling. I hear that. Now, the not doing Short Round dirty, I get it. But at the same time, he's left that part of his life behind. We can't write in what we wish. Of course, I wish Short Round was in all of them. He's amazing. I mean, he is the best thing about that movie. Like, Kate Capshaw is the reason that movie is my least favorite movie. Not just her performance as Willie Scott, but Willie Scott as a character is awful. And as I sent you the 2.5 minute supercut of her just shrieking, when Emma watched it the first time, my kid Emma looked at me and they said, I can't stand her. Like halfway through the movie, Emma says, I can't, is this going to keep up? The screaming's outrageous. So anyway, I hear that point, but I just think we're going on. If Indy is Spielberg's dad's, you know, is the avatar for Spielberg's dad or for Spielberg himself, if Spielberg sees himself as a flawed father, this is his moment now at this moment of life for him to get background. Because I think the funniest line in this, he's like, don't let anybody tell you anything different. If you want to fix motorcycles, boop, boop. And then when he finds out it's his own kid, he's like, you're going to go back to school. And there's that moment of now I, you know, so I get it. But I don't think, I mean, I think Short Round's missing from 3 and 4. I would have loved to have seen, because Key is so good. He's so good in Goonies. He was so good in this. It's a crime against humanity what happened to him, you know, but the fact that, you know, he made a good career as a stunt coordinator, and of course now he's an Oscar winner. So hopefully we can all fingers crossed next week or today when this comes out and we all go see it, there'll be a lovely cameo from him. Or that's the legacy sequel, because he's still in great shape. You know, he could go do that. So that's my counterpoint. I hear your point, I get it, but I do think if we're basing it in reality, air quotes, where there's aliens and gods and monsters and voodoo, then at least the human part of it is real.
Now, I want to add in here, a good point, Tony. I like that rebuttal. But I want to delve more deeply into Mutt as a character, less so as Mutt compared to Short Round. Because a weird thing with Indiana Jones is although this one does kind of break that, they feel like they're meant to be serialized. You know, the first three you can watch in any order because none of them necessarily, they don't connect to each other, do they?
No.
It's a new person, all new cast almost, apart from Indy.
They're Bond films. They are Bond films. Like, yeah, you know, there's the Indie Girl and there's the Indie Adventure and that's it.
But the fourth one doesn't. It's the first one to
kind of Felix Leiter.
Yeah, exactly. The fourth one's the first one to connect back, which is, I wonder, that'll be a thing to think about in this, because I haven't really considered that element before. But Scott, tell us about Mutt in itself and anything else you want to add to Tony's point.
Okay, so I'll just so firstly, I would say in Last Crusade, there is one in-joke when they are in the catacombs and he sees the Ark of the Covenant and he says, oh, it's the Ark of the Covenant. She says, how do you know? He says, I know. Like, I have a good idea. So there's a few of those. But with Mutt, the thing with Mutt in this is, like you say, for me, I think I'm going to expand on the point because of the characters that are added into this film. So Mutt is that sort of the young, he's the action piece. And there was this notion of continuing the legacy. Like, how do you continue Indiana Jones without Harrison Ford? Like, even in 2008, he was like, I think I'm done. I'm getting too old for this shit. Like, you know, I've got to hang up the hat. And then he went on and did Star Wars and another indie film and a lot of other stuff. Yeah. So there was this notion of like, oh, Shia LaBeouf is going to be the one to carry this on, potentially, like the son of Indiana Jones. And so as a character, like bringing him in and having him as this sort of like, you know, bitter, kind of sort of like restless greaser, I actually think kind of works. I think the character actually works in that sense. Like, I think Shia LaBeouf does it well. Like, the whole scene where he stands up, like, you know, he says about Mary Williams. He says, there's been a lot of Mary's, kid. And he's like, that's my mother you're talking about. And he's like, you don't have to get angry to prove how tough you are, like, every time. And it escalates and stuff throughout the film and, you know, their relationship and that. So I think the character works as a character. The problem comes when he does become this cipher for the adventure. When they're like, Indy can do some bits, but now we need this greaser that is apparently some sort of like Olympic level fencer, can swing through trees and does all this other stuff, you know, and you're like, oh, okay. Like, I see why they've brought this character in. He's the young one. Da 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 da. And it just feels a little hollow in that respect. Like that whole fencing sequence. And I've got a real problem with it. There's a scene in this where they've like been using guns and, you know, all this other stuff, and they've run out of ammunition. And Dr. Spalko, brilliantly played by Cate Blanchett, pulls out a sword, and then there's like a focus in on it. And I'm going like, what the fuck are you going to do with a sword between cars? Like, this makes no sense. And then, oh, no, you're going to have a sword fight. But luckily, Mutt is a, you know, an Olympic-level fencer. And I'm just like, this is, you know, this is the Pirates of the Caribbean, swashbuckling, sword fighting on a big rolling wheel, blah, blah, blah. Like, this, do you know what I mean? And that's where I'm like, I'm rolling my eyes, thinking like, okay, we've left behind the practical, and I understand there is silliness in the other films, but they had that practical thing where you'd accept them. They were in enough this side, the right side of the Uncanny Valley, to accept them. But Mutt just becomes more irritating throughout the film as he becomes more of this adventure thing. Do you know what I mean? I actually prefer him as an irritant, as a gruff character at the beginning to how he becomes towards the end. He becomes more of a thing. Like the whole bit where he throws the snake in for Indy to capture and all that. I mean, I hate that quicksand scene as well. But he throws the snake in and he's like, just catch it. And he's like, you know, he's like, get me someone else. He's like, look, I'll call it, it's just a snake, just a snake. And I'm just like, this whole, you know, this is just Indy's fear of snakes is, you know, well known, but like this humor's not working. Shia LaBeouf isn't comedy enough to do, for some reason in this film, like he's not comedy enough to do the, I don't want to get to the humor. So he works at the beginning, but the moment they transition him to actually acknowledging him as Indy's son, like he sort of drops off as he becomes worse as a character. And that sort of is the problem for me. Like I find him less engaging. Like, you know what the story is going to be, but he becomes less engaging throughout the film. But I feel that that's what this film does. It introduces characters that it sort of goes, oh, that's a good idea, and then has no idea what to do with them. And the two are the big Russian, who is sort of like the chief Russian henchman, who doesn't really talk, who's in it throughout. He's cool. And he's sort of like the big one that Indy's got to fight on and off. But I think he is massively underused, because I think like he's great. Like, he's really intimidating and he gets killed off by ants. And I'm just like, oh, man, like we had Pat Roach killed off by like a plane propeller in the first one, and then he plays the giant thuggy with, he gets crushed in the rock crusher in the second one, and then you've had like all these cool, like, you know, big villain deaths, and he gets killed by ants, and I'm like, oh, all right, that's a little bit of a letdown. But then you've got like Ray Winston playing Mac, who's another character introduced that, again, I'm sort of like, the only reason that Mac exists in this film is to switch sides so that the villains can find out where Indy is. That is the only purpose he serves in this film. And he keeps changing as well. So by the end of the film, I'm sort of like, I'm kind of bored of him. And so I find that, like, as the film goes on, as the plot sort of grows, like the characters don't, other than like Indy and Marion and a little bit, like the characters go through an arc, but like they don't really go through anything. In fact, they become less engaging as the film goes on. I think Mutt really suffers for that. Mac becomes an absolute liability throughout the second half of the film. Like, he keeps switching sides, and then he sort of leads the Russians to the temple, and then he's back on Indy's side, but then he sort of dies at the end, and they sort of, just before that, they make, you know, he's like, you know, I'm going to be all right. No, you're not. You're about to get torn to pieces by an interdimensional spaceship. Like this is, it's, there's just these redundant characters, and I sort of feel that Mutt becomes a redundant character by the sort of the end of the film. And that's a real shame.
That's certainly an interesting point. Tony?
I would say a couple of things. So this is where the script was well done. I hear what you're saying, but early on, when they're first doing their walk and talk, they're doing their Aaron Sorkin moment where they're walking around the town and he's telling him everything. He's like, yeah, my mom, she sent me to this private school with all this thing. And he says, I learned all this stuff. I learned to wrestle. I learned to fence. I learned to do. So it's there. It's not I hear. So of course, that's Chekhov's sword. I mean, she also has the sword early on because that's how he describes her.
Yeah. You know, I know a sword fight's coming.
Yeah, the rapier. Like, and of course, and because Indy, we know, isn't a sword fighter. That's not a skill set he has. And because of the... in the first one, and he shoots him, and then in the second one, where Wesley has dropped his gun, of course. So when they go to do the thing with the two sword guys in the second one / first one, he doesn't have a gun, which I get it. I hear what you're saying to all of that, but I would argue you still need something to drive it forward. And the difference is that these are all new characters, and that feels like, because Sala and Brody aren't there to do it, or Henry Sr. isn't there to move the plot along. That's what, like, Sala and Brody and Henry are the characters that are the Mac and the you know, these other characters. And
yeah, but they were new characters in the last one. Like, Henry Sr. was a new character, and Sala was in the first film. But they are better characters. Like, Sala is the digger and knows it, and in Egypt, and they go in, and he's like, you know, yeah, they're hiring all the best, the strongest backs, and all this other stuff. Like, he's the in to get him on the dig site. Like, you know, he's there for a purpose.
And so Mac is the in to make the bad guys follow him. But that's somebody that has to know.
He's not an in for them to follow. That is bad writing for someone to go, oh, I'm a double agent. No, are you a triple agent? No, I just wasn't a double agent. Like, it's all that stuff, like backing and forthing. Like, you know, when he finds him in Peru and takes him to the camp, and then he's dropping the silly jungle chase, like he changes sides again. He's like, I told you about Berlin. You know, we were double agents and all this other stuff. Like, I get they've got history, but it all is so contrived to reach, so that to make sure that all the characters are able to reach the next destination. I'm just like, there is better writing to be done that can facilitate this. Like, there's ways of doing this better. And I just feel like it's like, Mac is not a character. Mac is a plot cipher. He's redundant. But I know you said about the others, but they sort of, and maybe this is just Ray Winston's performance, but like, I like Salah in the first film.
Oh, I love Salah. I mean, you can't compare the two. Salah's going to come back for 5, right? So that's exciting. That's exciting too. I mean, he's such a great actor, you know, and I mean, you know, he's excellent in the Lord of the Rings movies. I mean, he can do anything, right? He's always good. He was on Sliders, one of my all time favorite sci-fi shows. Great show. He's amazing. He's such a great actor. But I hear what you're saying, but I mean, I feel like it's still called Indiana Jones and the, so like everybody is about him getting to wherever he needs. Mutt is a side character in this story. Mac is a side character, and it wouldn't make sense to have that be Salah because he's not an American national.
I
understand he's MI6, but you need that because now he's Colonel Jones. Like there's again, the little nuggets of here and there with John Hurt is great. You know, playing the crazy person, but again, he's still he. You could also still argue he's just fodder
an exposition.
For the plot, right? But he is totally Captain Exposition. But we need that.
Yeah,
and
I get
somebody
that.
To be. Yeah,
but the difference for me is you know, Salah serves a purpose in both Raiders and Last Crusade. Like he becomes on part of the journey, and he's intrinsic to things happening. Like. You know, like say that he's the in to the dig. He sort of helps him, you know, get down to the Well of Souls. He's there helping him get the thing out. Like he's the one that arranges the boat for them to get away. Salah's like connections are important to the plot. Now he drives the plot forward, so he is that thing. But more importantly, like he feels part of it. Do you know what I mean? Like he's part because they go to Egypt where the dig is, and he's part of it. And then when they bring him back in, like we've brought him in to find Brody because Brody's an idiot and going to get lost. So Salah's the best one to do it. So when they have the raid at the end, and he's like, you know, my brother-in-law needs camels, and he's like, you know, or horses, and you know, and in all that sort of stuff, like it all works. Like he's a likable character. You believe the relationship between Salah and Indy, or Brody and Indy, or all these other characters. The problem with Ray Winston's character is he's so abrasive throughout the whole thing. Like, I don't like him. But also, like, whenever these things happen, like you say, to sort of facilitate them, I feel the contrivance where I don't in the other films. So by the end of the film, when he's dropping those bloody tracker things for Spelko and the Russians to follow, I'm like, oh, you are literally just there to, like, straight away I was like, could Spelko not have just dropped something? We've already seen ridiculous sci-fi contraptions in this film. So could we not have had it that like she dropped one into the bag of the crystal skull when she had it in the thing and she's just tracking the skull with a device? Remove all of that.
May I cut in slightly here and I'll come to Tony in a moment. I think what's happening to a degree in this scenario is I think Tony's generally saying that all side characters move the plot in the way that Scott is saying all the side characters do in the new one. But I think the biggest issue here is that Mac is rubbish. I think Scott's basically saying that Mac's rubbish and that Tony's trying to say that it's all the side characters are kind of different. So I think what I'm going to do in this part, I will hear more from Tony with the side character part, but I think if we in this going forward on this just this specific topic of side characters, avoid Mac for the time being because in my mind I'm giving you a point there, Scott, because I think Matt's double agent back and forth stuff is just nonsense and it is just quite annoying and doesn't really serve a purpose apart from clearly being a plot device. However, I think Tony's point with some of the older characters in the first three, they are all basically doing the plot movement and Indy's kind of just falling through it. You know, there's the joke of Raiders.
Right.
He literally didn't even need to be involved in the whole film, but it's fun to be there with him. So Tony, I want to hear more from you about the side characters. Let's focus on some of those avoiding Mac for the time being. Cause I agree with Scott's point there.
I think it's easy to say, keep in mind, Mr. Burton, on your very first show, your question was, is it okay to punch a Nazi? Yes. The answer is yes. So, of course, the bad guys being Nazis, it's easy to have bad guys be Nazis. But, like, in the first movie, I will argue, I will say, not because, like, you can say, ooh, Belloc, or you can say, you know, whatever. They're all under Hitler. Like, so one in three, it's all about Nazis. And two, it's all these, like, you know, the big bad is not super well developed. And his reasoning is kind of trash and whatever. It's whatever. Mysticism, blah, blah. Kate Winslet is the best of the baddies. That is, I'm here to say. So as far
Kate
as
Blanchett,
side characters
Kate
go,
Blanchett.
Kate Blanchett, what did I say?
You said Winslet.
Kate Winslet.
Very, very different
I would love
film.
To see Kate Winslet. In, but yes, Kate Blanchett is the best of the baddies, in my opinion. Like her performance, not necessarily maybe the character, but it's 1957, so we're in the height of the Cold War. And so I think this idea to have it be a Russian, to have it mm-hmm. be her, to have it be a female villain, because the second one, or the third movie doesn't, there's no real villain. It's all still Nazis, and they're all working for Nazis, and it's all greed and whatever. And for her, it's not greed. Like, it's not just greed. Like, the money is irrelevant. It's knowledge. And I love that idea that the ultimate, the person who is, and I'm going to go out on a, I'm going to do a Farina here. She's his Irene Adler. For one moment, this woman that Cate Blanchett, she is Indy's equal in every way. Like, the woman that Sherlock
yes.
refuses to even call her a name, right? Once she leaves him, he's so butthurt, he only ever calls her the woman. For, like, the rest of all of the books and in the shows, they've done it and everything. He, like, can't call her Irene. She just, because she's as smart as him, she's as talented as him, and she doesn't need him. And this woman, and as much as Marion is his yin and yang, this woman is his Irene Adler, like is his equal in every way. So I think as far as side characters go, as far as baddies go, Crystal Skull gives us the best of the baddies. And I feel like the rest of the side, I love having Marion back. It's clear Willie Scott's everybody's least favorite, and there is no romantic interest. So obviously, as far as side characters go, Sala's number one, Henry Jones two, Brody, whatever. But they were well written out of this. So this movie, to me, giving him a son, giving him a villain. And then at the end point is what she wanted was knowledge. And like the conversation that he's a professor and, you know, he's kind of at the end of his career and they're forcing him out. And what is that going to mean? And as somebody who is a professor who feels that. So to me, this has got leaving Mac notwithstanding, I still think, and I think that the big Russian dude, I love having him come back and back and, it also makes sense to me. I'm okay with the ants killing him because, again, Indy can't beat him. And in all the cases, Indy always needs something else to kill.
Oh, 100%. I agree with that. Yeah.
You know, he's not James Bond. He gets the shit beat out of him. You know, so I'm here for that. And it's always some weird, it's not a deus ex machina because it's never really technology. It's always like something really basic and simple. But every time he has to beat somebody, it's something else. It's an accident. Marion shooting the guy and the thing moving or hitting the guy and the plane spinning around is the only reason he wins in the first place. So it's always an accident. To me, it's just more of the same. So that is my side character rant. I know I hung it just on Kate, but God, she's so good. And I don't know if it would have worked with somebody else.
Yeah. Oh, no, I agree. And I want to say, because I'd agree with you about Cate Blanchett. I don't consider her a side character. That's the thing. I consider her to be the primary villain. And I think her performance in this is fantastic. Like, she is the other thing I watch in this. Like you can't not watch her. And I think she is a more nuanced character than I think any of the others. Well, when I say psych, I think Marion is actually kind of like,
so you're like saying Marion, Shorty, Mutt, like,
yeah,
anybody?
There's Mac, Marion, Mutt. There's a couple of others that sort of like, even like, say, Oxley.
Yeah.
They're all sort of a piece, but they're a blur. Like even Marion, the problem I have with Marion in this, and it's sort of, is her introduction. I want to talk about it. I'm going to cover Spalko first because there is something I wanted to mention about her. Because I love that thing you've said. His Irene Adler. There's that scene at the end when the skulls are all there and they have them sort of either side of Oxley and they're both sort of like figuring it out together. Like I love that. Like you said, in that moment they are like of a piece. They are. You know, just want to know. She shows both confidence, fear, uncertainty throughout this film. Like, you see that, like, there are times when she sort of panics and she'll, like, pull out a gun or she'll do something or she'll be, like, frustrated. Like, she's not, like, a comedian. No, she's overplaying it with the accent stuff at the beginning. But you see her confidence get knocked throughout this film and stuff. And like, she's scared. So no, I think Cate Blanchett is awesome. Like, Cate Blanchett is absolutely fantastic in this film. So, and I agree, she's probably the best villain of the franchise to date. We've got Mads Mikkelsen coming up, and he's a belter as well. So let's see what happens. But the others to me are just there. I mean, Marion in Raiders, as you said, is sort of like his yin to yang. Like, she's an adventurer, she's strong, she's independent, she's often running a bar in Tibet, and she's got all this sort of shit, and she can look after herself, right? The moment she sort of walks out, and I get that she's older in this, and, you know, I'm not being ageist, but the moment she sort of walks out and she sort of puts her hands on her hips and she's like, Indiana Jones. And I'm like, you're in the middle of a camp of people that are wanting to kill you, and you're now going to play some sort of sitcom family moments throughout with the whole sand pit and all that kind of stuff. I'm like, I'm rolling my eyes. And then it gets when they escape the jungle thing, and she's like, jump in. And she's like, trust me. And she goes off a cliff, and she just so happens that the tree bends and gets them down to the water. And she's sort of like looking smug. And I'm going like, this isn't the Fast and the Furious. Like, I'm not accepting this kind of physics bending nonsense in a race, in like, you know,
the entire racetrack.
No, I agree. No, I hate it. I hate it in Temple as well. Like, the whole mine car thing is ridiculous in Temple, and I hate that as well. But then it goes down the sort of, you know, and just throughout it though, she doesn't like the whole bit when he sort of says, like, you know, she exposes, like, you know, she met that guy, Williams, the person she married. He was a good guy, all very good. And you say about him, and she says to him about, like, the human wreckage he leaves behind. So she's bitter. Yeah, no, she's angry at him, and she sort of left him the thing. And then she acknowledges the moment she acknowledges that Mutt's his son, all of a sudden she goes all like goo-goo eyes for him. And she's sort of like, and then he says, like, they weren't you, honey. And she's like, oh. And I'm like, fuck off. Like, this is ridiculous. All of a sudden she's become the next indie girl, and it's like back to being this kind of thing. I'm like, there's just this downgrading of characters at the end for, like, just to facilitate the ending of the film. I feel the ending should have just been Indy versus Spalco trying to get to that last thing. Like, everyone else is literally become superfluous.
Well, he tries to make it be that, and I feel
and I think Spielberg should have stuck with Indy.
Well, I hear that, but what I would say is, the point of it is, and this is why this one is called not Indiana Jones and Child Endangerment, but Indiana Jones and the Spiritual or Emotional Growth, is that he realizes he's not alone. Even at the end of the third movie, when they all ride off into the sunset together, it's like him and three dudes. And yeah, one of them's his dad, but like, these aren't going to be his partners. Yes, they're his family. They're his found family, and they all love each other. And I love it. I love how they love each other. Like, I love how much Sala loves Indy. And I love how much Indy loves that. Like, I'm so excited for him to be back in the third one. So I'm here. And Brody and Henry Sr. have that long history. That is, like, real, true, like, vulnerable male love you stuff. So I'm here for it. But it's not, they're all older than him. It's not a life for him. So this is the moment where them all being there, being his backup dancers, like, we got you. You know,
Okay.
I'm here.
So are you telling me this is, I got family. Is that what this is?
I am. I've never seen those movies. So
can I say I hate it in them.
I get what you're saying.
And I hate it in this, where it's like, we're going to continue. And I hate it in films when they do that. Like, but we're family and we're going to stick together. And I'm like, well, if you're a good parent, then you're going to go, no, this is incredibly dangerous. I want you to be safe. This makes no sense. I've still got to go stop the Russians. I don't want to be worrying about him endangering short round for one year, technically. But they've learned his lesson. I don't know. They become redundant to the actions that take place. Like, they literally just follow him through a temple, and it's like, they don't serve a point.
Save him. I mean, they're there to help.
Not really. They don't do anything. Like, Indy figures out the thing with the skull, puts it in the thing. Like, Oxley's probably the only other one that should be there. He figures out the thing with the skull and puts it in there. Like, that's it. And he even says, like, he's the one that shouts to Oxley. Like, when they all fall over, right, they all run through, and the Indian, the temple guards, those sort of, like, Inca kind of, and they look cool as well. Like, I love some of the designs in this are great. When they're all sort of, like, whipping them, they're all falling down, they all shout for Indy, Jonesy! Indy! And then Indy's the one who has to go, Oxley, how did you get out of this before? And he picks the skull up, right? So they aren't being, they're not going, Marion's not going, oh, who's seen the skull, believes in the skull, seen what it can do, isn't going, Oxley, clear the way. Like, they have to rely on Indy. And I get that, it's an Indiana Jones film. But again, they become luggage for the climax of this movie. And it's so, it becomes quickly evident that they, you know, I'm saying they're ciphers, but they are just there to be luggage.
I feel like, I hear that. And you
really damages that film.
You can totally argue that. But I argue that they're not luggage, they're stakes. It adds different stakes for him because these are the people that he now, that he loved. Like, that's his future wife, the woman he has let go twice in his life, and now she's back, and now he's got this son. And you know, and somewhere in there, we know he's got another son out there.
So why isn't he the one? Right, if that's the stakes, and he's thinking that, why is he not the one then pushing them out the room when shit starts going down and the aliens all become one? Like, it's actually Mac who drags him out. Like, they have to drag him out of the thing when he's like, and he's like, oh yeah, better go. Like, you know, it.
Right, because he needs them to sit, because he's so focused on the thing, just like her. She's him. Like, again, to use the very, you know, because he's very Batman.
Yeah.
It's one bad day. The difference between him and Spelko is one bad day.
Can we just say, all right, I like that phrase. But let's say that we've also done this before then, because this is the same as, so we've seen that, all right, and Indy doesn't learn a lesson, because we've also seen this when the Grail falls down into the chasm at the end of 3, at the end of Last Crusade, and it takes his dad. He's going, like, I can reach it, Dad. He's like, Indy, give me your other hand. And he turns round and climbs out and you know, and leaves it. So I see what you're saying, but we've already done that. Like, Indy should have learned that lesson, and you know, we should show
he's
that
he's
had growth.
Brody's dead and his dad's dead, and he's stepping backwards. And you know, Jim Broadbent is there, and who doesn't want Jim Broadbent? I wish Jim Broadbent was my boss. You know, it's like, it's not the same. He's not Brody. So I hear it. I'm not saying that's not a valid criticism, but I feel like it is. It's, I don't feel like it's luggage. I feel like it's character development. And that's what I'm super geeked about. To me, this is the link. And again, I've not gone total Tanya and not seen any trailers, but I've only watched one trailer once. And from what I understand, what's her face from Fleabag is playing
Goddaughter.
So it's Brody's must be related to Marcus. So that's,
I believe so.
Super cool. I'm excited. Mm. So it's another part of his family, because we know Marcus was super important. Yeah. Like, Marcus was a figure.
His father figure, yeah, like his mentor, whilst his dad was.
So it's all family, even though Mangold is directing.
Let me put in the thing to cover off why this is luggage, and we want Indy to feel bad, good about
this. Will be your last point on you, and then Tony gets one rebuttal, and then we'll move to something out of side characters.
We've said not to talk about Mac, right? And you talked about family, right? So you've got Marion and Oxley, right? Because they obviously have the past, so that's the family, right? And although you've had the irritation of Mac betrayals back and forth, they kill him off, and they actually have him say, "I'm gonna be all right." After you found out that he's basically duplicitous, he's, you know, he's a gambler, like he's trying to steal all this gold, and he actually tells Indy it's all right, so Indy can go away conscience free and enjoy his life with his family. I'm sorry, that is such saccharine bullshit for you to be able to have that like that. That is someone just going, oh no, I'm luggage and I know I have to leave because I can't be in the last scene of this film. So, but I'm going to make it all right for everybody by saying that I'm okay with dying. Although throughout the film, I've shown that my survival instincts has been constantly about betraying people to find the best outcome so I can survive. It's a nonsense that.
Well, but then that would also argue, we all agree that the third movie is the best, but that is the same thing. What Ilsa does the exact same thing. It's the same ending. He has the same ending as her. When she wants the thing, and because her greed, and she keeps reaching for it, and she doesn't end by saying it's okay. She ends in terror. So to me,
she ends, her glove falls off. She slips out because her glove falls off.
Right, but she's also terrified because she thinks she's going to get the thing. And so this is him saying, like, Indiana Jones and the emotional growth. This is Mac saying it's okay. I'm okay. Agree. Of course, the joy of this show is the agreement.
Yeah.
I think we've hit the bedrock here. It's just two different opinions with both good points made with these side characters. But I think we've exhausted that. So, you know, we need to wrap this up within half an hour. So obviously we'll start to wrap up in about 15 or so minutes to make final statements. But there's the one big thing about this film which connects to George Lucas more than anything. And it is one of the main criticisms by the mainstream of this movie. And I think it links in with something that Scott said early on in this. And obviously, it's the aliens. Is it in the past three things, you know, you've had two severely religious connected things. And then Temple of Doom is a bit not
religious. Well, it's still religious. It's based around...
It's religion.
It's
not Christianity. It's
a different kind of religion, and we won't get into the minutiae of, in Temple of Doom, how whether or not it was culturally appropriate, because they come up with a nice little warning on Disney Plus now saying, sorry about that. So we won't delve into that
stuff. Indiana Jones and the casual racism.
So do the aliens fit in with Kalimar, the Holy Grail, and the Ark of the Covenant? So I think we'll start off with the defense from Tony.
Sure.
Because I think most people know in the mainstream of the standard methods of attack, in air quotes, and then I'm sure you guys will bounce across the back and forth. So Tony, please tell us, what do you think of the aliens and how does that affect indie, and, you know, go for it.
They've designed them to look like the aliens that everybody says they've been abducted by. Like, these are the South Park aliens. These are the aliens that everybody... X-Files aliens. These are the ones. So I'm fine with that. Like, because you're playing into the zeitgeist. The movie begins in Area 51 in New Mexico, which is where, you know, all this shit goes down. And so it's... I'm here for it. They tell you from the beginning it's about aliens because of where it is. Like, when the doors open, it says 51. So we know from the jump, it's about aliens. Like, it's right there. And then you find out that the Ark is there. So it's like all kinds of weird shit is out here. That's all good. I'm here for it. All right. So, but then Oxley says they're not spacemen. When Mutt says, are they spacemen? He says they're interdimensional beings. So this is the multiverse at work. That's what this is. They're not aliens. They're from a different version of Earth. They're from a parallel dimension.
They're from the space between
spaces. Space between spaces.
Yeah, I love that line.
Whatever you want to say, I mean, yes, they look like aliens, so that's what we're shorthanding it. I'm fine with that because this isn't an argument that George Lucas invented. This isn't an argument that Spielberg or who did Kazan wrote this one? Who wrote Kasdan? Not Eli Kazan. Sorry, everybody. But did Kasdan write this one? I can't remember.
I think so.
Okay.
Fact check.
So whomever actually wrote the screenplay. My problem isn't with it because historically speaking, this is a conversation that has always been happening. It's what was in The Fifth Element, right? Our good friend Luke, who's amazing, and everybody, you know, Fifth Element, that's also about aliens. And there's an argument to be made. People make it. There's an entire series on the History Channel. Ancient Aliens. Yeah. people argue that aliens had a hand in making Stonehenge and making the pyramids and whatever. Whether you believe in that or not remains to be seen. Mike, you're going to tell us who really wrote it. I'm wrong. Yeah.
So, directed by Steven Spielberg, I knew that. Screenplay by David Koepp. Story by George Lucas and Jeff Nathanson, but then based on characters by George Lucas and Philip Kaufman.
Okay,
yeah. So all of them had a hand in things.
So Kasdan is Star Wars only. I don't know why I thought he was over on this side of Lucasfilm too. But anyway, so the argument is that this isn't something that Lucas made up. This is something from the zeitgeist. People have said for years, this is the thing, aliens. People try to look at like some cave paintings, especially South American cave paintings. And some of them people will argue like, is that a representative of these are things that exist in the world. And so to lean into that isn't that unheard of. You know, so, and it is still you have to believe that, like, whatever it is. And this is a thing I'm going to say out loud, and it's totally true. And I know, Scott, you did the ghost thing. You asked everybody if they believed in ghosts, and I do first. But number one, the thing I totally believe we're real, which is also cave paintings, dragons. And here's why. Because all around the world, thousands and thousands of years ago, people painted dragons on their walls. And obviously, it just meant they were remnants of they're probably just dinosaurs, right? They were just pterodactyls that still happened to live, because of course the last dinosaurs would be the ones that could fly away from the end of the world. But all around the world there's these drawings, so the argument is the same, the dragons and aliens, is that all around the world on cave paintings, people who couldn't communicate, there was no internet, there was no phones, they couldn't send letters, they didn't speak the same language, there's these images of creatures coming from space. So it's rooted in history, but you have to have faith to believe it. And all the other three movies are about, I mean, we see that in the second movie, the voodoo doll works. Indy doesn't believe in voodoo, but it still works on him, right? And so there's always just enough of like, you can still be a skeptic, because if someone else's faith is real, it's like J.M. Barrie, I do believe in fairies, I do. So I'm here for it because it was like you can shit on it because it's not what you wanted, but it doesn't mean it's unrealistic to say aliens makes perfect sense to me because it's set in Peru.
Right, just before Scott jumps in, Lawrence Kasdan wrote Raiders.
He was the screenwriter
for Raiders, and then for completion's sake, Gloria Katz and Willard Hyuk wrote Temple of Doom, and then Jeffrey Boehm wrote Last Crusade. So Lawrence Kasdan did write Raiders.
For some reason, I thought he was there, but then I was like, maybe he's just on the Star Wars side. Either way, he and George go way back, for sure.
Scott, thoughts on Aliens, if you like it or don't, just thoughts?
Well, no, I'm going to give thoughts. And first off, outright, actually, I've got no problem with the Aliens. It makes sense. I think, you know, you've done three during the sort of world, pre-Second World War, the rise of Hitler, the Nazis. There's this whole idea of Hitler and the occult, which is obviously sort of, you know, a big part of it. That's the driving force of both Raiders and Last Crusade. The story of the Kalimar and all that kind of thing. It's the thuggy, like it's sort of based in history, but they give it this sort of slightly perverse version of it for indie and whatever. I'm all fine with that. In fact, I love those. The problem I have is, and firstly, I would say things, right? So you say about the ancient aliens, like I actually just wrote an article about this for a magazine that I wrote for. So I would also say it goes back even further. So I'm going to hold up a couple of things just for the video. So if you can see that, that's Quatermass and the Pit, written by Nigel Neal, came out in 1958. That's about aliens coming to Earth 5 million years ago and changing our DNA. I'm a big fan of that. I have actually got you a reference in it. I have actually got a copy of Chariot of the Gods, written by Eric von Daniken, which is the exact thing you were saying, and he's referenced sort of in this book. That was from 1962, I think, 1963, from that. And that's where he references the Nazca lines, he references several other things that are all, they came from this book. And the idea is that these ancient aliens came to Earth, or aliens, they weren't ancient at the time, obviously, they were aliens. Aliens came to Earth in ancient times and gave us the technology and the knowledge to build the pyramids in both Egypt and the Inca pyramids, and gave us technology to do a lot of other things as well. And we took on some of their culture, which is why we have these sort of like quite advanced yet barbaric sort of cultures in ancient history, much like the Mayan and the Inca, that sort of thing. So I'm kind of cool with all that. I'm fine with it. I think it's a good... it's a good thing to go. 50s was about sci-fi. You know, you've got those 50s sci-fi films of, Alien Invasion was a big thing. That the Alien Invasion, obviously, representation of the Cold War. That's the whole point, you know, that there was this fear of invasion. So it works with them being the Cold War and the Russians. So actually, I thought choosing Aliens was a cool move. The problem I do have, though, is going back to this idea of faith and Indy being the skeptic. So if you go back to Raiders and all the films, but let's start with Raiders. At the start of the film, you have the two guys coming from the US intelligence, and they give all this exposition about what the Ark is and this idea that, you know, if any army that carries it before it is undefeatable and it fires out lightning. And like, you know, even in Indy's like, oh, it's whatever. Like, it's a representation. It's biblical interpretation, da, da, da. And throughout the entire film, it's just... it's an object. Like, they find it, it's beautiful, it's carved out of gold and all this other stuff, but it's an object, right? It's not until the very last reel of the film that you experience the supernatural element of it, the sort of, you know, the things, the beautiful sort of waif spirits that come out and then become demonic and attack people. You don't see that till the very end. So there's no sort of like supernatural, it's an adventure, supernatural. And Indy doesn't even see it because he closes his eyes. Right, and the same really with Temple. They see sort of from a distance when the guy takes his heart out and it burns, and they're like, "Did I just see that?" Like, they can't. It's never 100%, and it's not until the end when they're on the bridge, as you said, that he starts trying to pull Indy's heart out, and then he sort of, and Indy says the thing with the stones. Right, again, adventure, supernatural. Right, and then again the same with Last Crusade. It's not until the very end that you find that the cup of Christ does its thing. So it's adventure thingy. So throughout the entire thing, the skepticism is always Indy going, it's a cup, it doesn't do anything, it's ridiculous, like, you know, da da da. And at the end, it saves his father, it sort of gives it, you know, eternal life, blah blah blah. So you have all those, but in this one, like you say, the problem I have is the storytelling techniques. They go, and this is David Coop all over, by the way, because I've seen him. Like, I'm not. He's a good storyteller, but he sometimes wants to blow his load too early. So they go to Area 51, and the first thing they show you is oh no, we've got a mummified body in here that's magnetic and it's linked with Roswell. So they're sort of telling you, it's alien. But you see the damn thing. Like they show you his hand comes out and you go, oh, it's aliens. And then when they go to the camp, the Russians have literally got an alien body in the camp. And I'm going, well, first of all, I don't know why you've got that. Are you just sort of carrying it around as something to do? Like, I don't know why you've got this thing. But they've got an alien body. And the skull throughout, like the skull's magnetic, it repels ants, it has magical powers, it brings on psychic images, like, and then at the end, so by the time you got to the end, you go, oh yeah, of course this is aliens. Of course you've got aliens. Like, there's no big surprise, because you've not, instead of going skeptic adventure, supernatural, you've just gone, it does this, and this, oh, and this, and that, and you're going to find it here, and we're going to do something else with this, and we're going to see some aliens. And like, so the mystery, like, this is why I love the indie films, is because they're an adventure film that's sort of grounded, but they're like weird fiction. Like, it's all, you know, my love for weird fiction.
It's all pulp. Yeah, for
it's
sure.
It's all pulp. Yeah. It's all grounded in reality to an extent, enough, but then you introduce that one wrinkle that tells you, oh, but it's weird. Like, there's something off kilter. But with Crystal Skull, it's literally like, here's the skull. It does all this stuff, and I'm going to show you aliens, and it's going to do all this stuff, and then you're going to have interdimensional aliens at the end. It's like, no, you, like, you say about Spalko and Indy, like, Indy shouldn't be a skeptic throughout this film, because he keeps seeing stuff that's like, well, that's weird. It should be this idea of, like, if someone comes up to you and says, I believe in ancient aliens, right? And you go, what's your evidence? And you go, well, the pyramids. How do they make the pyramids? Or, like, you know, they can give you this evidence, but you go, well, you can't really prove it. You're giving me circumstantial evidence. Like, I think you're clearly a little bit mad. But I understand your faith in this. I understand, like, you know, you have faith. You are seeing these things and you've come to that conclusion. But I've not seen anything that proves that. Spalko should be that character. Like, you know, that film, The Men Who Could...
Stare at Goats.
The Men That Stare at Goats. The same thing, like...
That's real, though. Those were real.
Oh, no, it is. Yeah. But exactly. But they said, like, oh, we could make goats fall over. And there's other people going, like, they're nuts. Like, they were just sort of, like, you know, they were punching them out or something. Like, I don't know what's going on. But, like, there is this thing of, like, psychic... In the 50s and 60s, there was this idea of investigation into psychic warfare. But it sounds crazy. But this film validates it from the beginning. Like, although Spalko is great, and I love Cate Blanchett in this, you should never believe her throughout this film. Like, she should be the crazy one that where Indy's going, like, you know, she's like, I've seen some stuff, but this, like, she's off a rocker. You know, it's obsession, and like, it could even, like, Oxley's condition should be like, oh, he's got diphtheria. He's got these symptoms he has are because he spent time in the jungle. Like, unfortunately, he's got this disease, right? And then you should have the reveal at the end, which is, oh no, aliens are real. This isn't a crystal skull. It's a skeleton. It's a crystal skeleton. Da-da. And then it should be a massive reveal at the end. So I'm fine with the aliens. In fact, I think the aliens are a great idea. It's just the storytelling. And again, this goes back to the spirit of Indy. It gets so excited about its concept that it wants to tell you about it all the time. So by the time I get to the end, I'm just like, all right.
That's a very, well, very good point made. Go then, Tony.
I would say, and again, so my point is that I hear all that. That all makes sense. I mean, you could argue, you know, this is the only one where the cold open is a direct relation to the whole story, where the cold open and the other three obviously set up what happens. You know, we meet Belloc, we meet Willie. What's the third? Well, it's young Indy in the third cold open. So, but again, it sets up the you know, him getting the thing and this and that.
Cross of Coronado.
Yeah, the Cross Coronado. So, like, it's, so those are setting up the story where it's not as a direct. So you could, I hear that. But however, this goes back to me saying this one is Indiana Jones and the emotional growth. He's older now. He has been through the shit. And so he is more like, he's had time alone without a wife, without a kid, without a dad, without a mentor, without a stepdad, Brody, and without, you know, Salah lives in Egypt. So I can argue that in those 20 years from the one to the other, he's been able to be contemplative, and he's like looking at the end of his career. He just gets fired in this too. He's been through the war. He's Colonel Jones. Like, he's seen shit. And I just feel like, so for me, I hear what you're saying, but my argument is that is a shorthand. His belief is shorthand to, you know, as we age, you know, people say, oh, as you get older, you get more conservative. I've always said, as I've gotten older, I've got more liberal. Julie and I have talked about this extensively. It's like when I was younger, I was like libertarian, and now I'm like liberal. Give everybody everything. Fuck you, conservative assholes. So it's like I just feel like it's that idea that people do change, and especially with time and distance. So I mean, this is the reason I'm keen on this film, and the reason I think that works. I get what you're saying, and it's a valid point that it is different than the other movies, but that's the point. That is what I'm here to defend. This is different than the other movies because they didn't film it in 1992. He's not, it, this doesn't take place at the beginning of World War II. I mean, World War II is obviously happening in the other one, but the American, we don't see him become Colonel Jones. And this is also like Korea's happening there too, right? So like shit's going down. So communism being the threat, the Cold War, all of that is real and that is really happening. And I appreciate that India is a different person for that. And it's all just done with throwaway lines. And we don't see it. I would have loved to have had an Indiana
Oh,
Jones movie every 5 years, but they weren't here for it. Grumpy Harrison Ford, oh, I'm not doing that shit. Whatever. Fine. So to me, I hear you. It is supposed to be different. It's like when Mike and I did our Weezer show, and it's like people get mad that the most recent Weezer isn't like the first Weezer. Right. Because they're not
but they're
19
different.
anymore.
No, but right, that's fine to be different. But the whole point is there's no mystery. You're saying this is a reflection of sort of Indy's point. But the beginning of the film, like, Indy's still skeptical at the beginning. Like, when you have the FBI come in, who, and I can honestly, I'm going to throw this little side point. I really struggle when actors come in as character actors that I've known so from other things. So the FBI come in, and I'm like, oh, it's the janitor from Scrubs. And then
I thought the same thing.
And then the colonel comes in to defend him and says, you don't know how many medals is this, you know, son of a bitch has got. And I'm like, oh, it's Jim Robinson from Neighbours. Like, I can't disassociate him from
And
other
Dan
things.
Aykroyd in the second movie.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
They're
it's
like,
really
why is Dan
difficult.
Aykroyd doing a terrible British accent? What's
Yeah.
happening? What? Yeah, I hear you. Okay.
But anyway, but the point is that, so in that, like, they talk about Roswell, the crash. And he says, well, you were there. And I'm like, well, why the hell did they bring out, firstly, why did they bring out an archaeologist? But you say, like, there's things that he's done that would be relevant, perhaps. And even then, he's like, yeah, he took us to a crash site. There was some debris and some stuff. Like, we saw some bodies, but, like, yeah, it wasn't anything exciting. Like, you know, what was that? It was classified, and we were all told to shut up. Like, his skepticism is there. Like, he's not changed. He's still skeptic. And even sort of like when he's confronted with Spalco at the beginning, he's like, oh, she's into, you know, they say about like psyops. And he's like, ugh. Like, even you can tell Indy's like, oh, it's such crap. Like, he's still that skeptic, sort of like, that might just be Harrison Ford. I don't know. He's always like,
Whatever.
but like, yeah. But
Listen
like,
up, Blanchett.
yeah. But it's just the storytelling. Like, there's no tension for me in the reveal at the end because I'm like, well, I know there's aliens because you've shown me them. Like, I don't feel that there's no tension around this crystal skull being either a deity construct that he says about, like an Inca deity artifact, or a crystal skull, or an actual crystal. No, but I know it's an actual crystal skull because it keeps doing shit, and you've shown me aliens.
I
So
think with
there's
this
no
point,
surprise at the end.
I think you've both said a lot of stuff on this point, which is
Sorry.
interesting to note. I was going to say, just because of the time constraint, I think we've got time for one more point for you to kind of each somewhat make. This will be, as we've got less time, it'll be less so trying to make points against the other one necessarily, but more so kind of final points that we haven't talked about yet, because we've spoken about side characters, we've spoken about Indy's growth and the emotional beats of things, we've spoken about the main villain, we've spoken about the aliens, we've spoken about Mutt and the father-son relationship. So what I want from each of you is a one point or a couple of points of just something, a reason you think this film is held in good regard that is a counterpoint, because you're very, very close at the moment, and I want more reasoning why and slightly less of one saying to the other
Is he
one,
going into
not that one.
slow-mo?
Oh, sorry.
Oh,
I've just come back. Sorry. It just
no,
popped
you're
up
back
saying
now.
internet
All is
connection
back. Yep,
unstable.
you're
Right.
back.
Okay. I'll just say then,
Yeah,
just smaller
okay.
points. Not necessarily a point to counter the other one's point. I'm
Yeah,
more
of
interested in
course.
points just on your side. So start with you,
Three each.
Tony.
So we just say
Yeah.
three
Three
quick things
kind
that we
of
want in
quick
our
fire.
closing
Yeah.
100%. Sure.
100%. So Tony, you go
Yeah,
first.
great. Fair enough. So yeah. So my closing statement is first, Scott, thank you. This has been a joy. I would love
No,
to
it's
talk to
wonderful.
Indiana Jones all day. Mike, thank you for doing
We'll be
this.
able to
So
do plugs at the end as well. But yeah, sorry.
Yeah, of course. But my three final points, things we didn't talk about that were in my notes. Why I feel like this is a valid fourth film and why it doesn't deserve to be shat on the way that it does. Number one, it was the nostalgia lens, right? Everybody wanted it to be something that that they thought the other ones were. But if they go back and do what I did and watch all four of them in a row, this is exactly like Indy grows in the film. Like there's a personal growth, but it has the DNA. There's a silly stunt, thinks the laws of physics go out the window. There's a belief in a higher power. There's a relationship between Indy and, you know, and a person he's striving for something. So all the beats are still there. So it's just because it's slightly different. He's older. People didn't like Shy or whatever. So that's, so to me, it falls in that because of that. I think, and I know Scott's going to bring this up too, so it'll be interesting to hear his side of it. I still think, while this isn't as funny as the third one, I do think that it does the things that it's supposed to do, the things that it's spoofing a little while doing it. It's very self-aware. This one's probably more self-aware than the other ones. By showing the arc and by showing some of those things, it's also self-aware of who Harrison Ford is. And so I like that about it. I like the self-awareness that Harrison Ford knows he's coming back. He gets it. He gets this as a legacy. He gets this is supposed to spin it off. And this was his way of saying, you will not replace me with Shia LaBeouf. If he's going to be in the new Indiana Jones movie, he will be my son. He will not be, you know, and if they want to replace me with Phoebe and she wants to go on and have her own adventures, great, but she will not be Indiana Jones. So I feel like he thought this would be his last rodeo, and I feel like he was giving us that final performance. And then at the end, I just want to come back to this is, if people say like it was such a perfect ending and whatever, this to me, if you're looking for all the nostalgia, this hit it all. The hat comes back, Marion comes back. You know, we see the picture of Brody. We see the picture of the dad. This is, if this were the last movie, I would be happy that this, I'm glad there's a fifth one. But to me, this is a nice, you know, pin in the Indiana Jones universe that we didn't have to just wait for, you know, somebody to write a novel about. We didn't have to do a novelization. We just got to have it there. So I just feel like it is a love letter to the other three films while still being its own thing.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Go on then, Scott, your three points.
Yeah, you mentioned about you know, not as funny as I actually think, you know, although there's a difference between humor and comedy, and I've said this about a number of things. I think this is the thing where the third one's humorous, like it manages to make it manages to do humor in a really good way without undermining things, and this one I think tries to introduce comedy, and I think it falls short, and I think I again feel this is because of the tone of the films that were being made at the time that it was trying to compete with. And again, you know, we can go to the fact of the fridge, the introduction of the gopher. Like I'm surprised the gopher didn't sort of like Caddyshack dance for a second or two. It introduces things like but the human is, like you say, because of who Harrison Ford is, and even the character that Shire's playing, the humor sort of like always feels slightly falls flat for me. There are humorous moments that are more funny than the comedy moments in this. Like one of the best scenes for me in this is the car chase in, is it whatever, what university is it, Harvard?
You never know what,
okay,
they're in California.
Okay,
you never so actually know where he works. So I have always kind of assumed it's like USC or UCLA,
right?
But we never know for sure.
So whatever university town, that car chase is good because it's actually filmed on streets. It's outside it and it looks really good. But there's a great bit where they go through the library and they're getting back up and they sort of, the comment is, you know, you've got to go out in the field. And that sort of, then he drives off and he tells that kid to read something. And this sort of, I like that. It's a nice humorous moment. You know, it's a bit of a nod. Then they'll go, oh, humor is him sword fighting and he's going to get hit in the nuts repeatedly by plants, and you know, it's like that's not it, it just doesn't work. And so I think this film tries to be funny to compete with pirates and the things that were going on, and it falls, and I find it eye rolling in that sense. It's like you say, the branch falling into the water for the car to land on and all that kind of stuff irritates me. So I don't think it is funny. I honestly don't think this film is funny. The other thing I think that's a point you say about nostalgia, but the other thing is we knew the other films were set in their era, right? It opens, it will say like, you know, I think the first one's like 1935, then Raiders is 36, and then Last Crusade is like 38 or 39.
39
like
and 1912. Yeah, 1912 for the beginning, yeah.
Yeah. So you know that because you've got the dates, but they don't sort of like ram it down your throat and they're not like, 1930s. This one is a bit like, it's just screaming like, don't forget you're in the 1950s. Like, here's a hot rod drag racer. Here's greasers. here's something else. Like, it just constantly wants to tell you it's in the 50s without just going 1955 or 1957, I think it's supposed to be. And again, so it's just sort of like, it's so heavy-handed repeatedly with this stuff that I'm sort of like, you know. So the whole sequence at the beginning with not Area 51, I kind of like the chase that's in that, you know, when he's like, he's too old, he's a bit too old to do some of the swinging and stuff like that. And again, like, you know, I'm kind of not too old for this shit. I like some of that. But then you're like, but don't forget, we also had nuclear weapons. So they're going to have a nuclear bomb. And you're just like, all right, okay, well, that's surely going to kill him. No, because we also had lead-lined fridges. And you're just like, oh, for Christ's sake. Like, it's so heavy-handed. And again, like that humor and stuff, again, with the gophers and that, I'm just like, ugh. It just sort of feels, drags me down. So that's the other thing. I sort of like, the humor doesn't, I don't think the humor works. I think the ramming of the 50s feels heavy-handed. Like, especially for Spielberg, like, there's so little. It just feels so heavy-handed for Spielberg, but there's no nuance about the era. Just going, yeah, it's set in the era. Like, I've seen, like, Munich, you know, these other films that he's done, these period pieces where it's just like, yeah, it's just set in the 80s and 70s, just rock on, like, you know. And then the final piece, really, is this thing about the ending, for me. Marrying Marion, you know, so they get married at the end and they've got this whole point, and then the whole thing with the hat, with you know, Shia picking it up and then Indy taking it off and putting it on and all that sort of thing. And like you say, it's saying this thing of, you know, no, you're not going to be Indy. It's a really weird message to the audience that sort of like says, like, you know, we've seen three where a previous character sort of said, you got hired, kid, and puts the hat on Indy, you know, and that's how it transitions to the boat. This one is literally Indy going, not a fucking chance, son, and leaves. And I'm like, so what? You don't want the legacy? So you've said about this whole thing around family. Yes, there's a smirk to it, but it's a really weird message to say to the audience when he, like, you know, he could have just grabbed it and then put it on, like, Shia's head or something like that. But, like, I don't know, the ending of this film set, like, is such a mixed message to the audience that I was just like, oh, you don't even know where you want this to go. Like, you know, it was so bizarre. So yeah, I shall end on those points, really.
Very interesting points made here. Very interesting. I've been taking lots of notes. As I said, I didn't come in with anything. I was willing to be fluid. And this is incredibly even. As in, down to the T, I've got points on either side. So I'm going to very briefly go through them. And then I'm hoping by then I'll have made my final decision.
You're still making it.
It's very, very tough. You've both made some very, very good points. So, obviously, Tony, with his defense, starting off, you know, it was those rumors that affected it, as well as Shia LaBeouf and those sort of things, as well as the nostalgia machine and the lens and it being a certain period of time after and people kind of seeing what they want to see and things. You've got Marion and Indy's growth as characters and things. One of your counters to one of Scott's points that I'll come to is that side characters, the weaker ones, are just there to move the plot. You said they do in other films as well. Cate Blanchett's great. And then
in general, by the way, that's
not just all things. In general. Whatever she's in, it's good. Yes.
And then she talks about heavy metal, and then she annoys me. But yeah, aside from that, I think she's a phenomenal actress. Humor's a bit more self-aware than other stuff. It's kind of grown with the audience, and you think there's a. I think what was the last point I've got here written down? Oh yeah, a point being, it's as good as, or maybe the worst points of the film are kind of even to Temple of Doom in a lot of ways, so it shouldn't be that. So they're the sort of Tony side. So then with Scott's side, we've got the CGI, the scenes don't feel very real. So especially the CGI parts, it feels very closed in, it doesn't feel large, it feels like a set. It feels like you're not in a world of adventure, you're filming a movie. You've got the, obviously Mutt is generally a worse short round, why don't you have them in? But although he is kind of a good character to begin with, and you like him and his performance, he becomes a weaker side character, which aligns with the next point, which is the side characters not only weaken as the film continues on, but the side characters don't seem to serve much purpose, especially towards the end, and that Mac is pretty awful, both as a character in universe, but also written being a double, triple, quadruple, no take-backs agent. So,
no takebacks. I like that part.
Yeah, basically,
say that.
Yeah. Well, I crossed my fingers when I said I wasn't a double agent, so I actually am, but I'm not. Then you've got the aliens showing validity from the start. So the rest of the films, it's that air of mystery. Is it, you know, is it actually mystical? And then that shock at the end, especially of the first one. Whereas in this one, literally first scene, you know, it's aliens and you know, it's true. And they don't pull away from that, which Tony says is a stronger point. You say is a weaker point, which are both interesting perspectives. And then the ending is very confusing with what is the legacy of Indiana Jones? Is it just basically Harrison Ford or is anyone can pick up the mantle? What do the kids watch? So both of those are very, very well put together arguments, I'd say. You know, I think the strongest points from Scott's side, I would say, is the unreal feeling parts where it feels like it's on a set. That's a very, very strong point. And the alien showing validity, that's a very strong point as well, I hadn't considered. And that the side characters weaken as the film continues, I get that, but the Mac part is especially heinous. With Tony's side, the strongest points I've sort of found is the nostalgia lens does hurt that. Cate Blanchett is the best villain ever, and then in the context of these films, and then also the film itself, the worst parts are as bad as Temple of Doom in certain ways. So very, very close here. It's a really, really hard one. And rewatching these films recently as well, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to say...
He's going to punt.
It's it. I'm going to pull it. I'm going to pull it. Here we go. Where are we going to go? Pulling it in. Drum roll and things.
Coming up, the judge returns with the verdict. I'm Thomas. I'm trial.
The verdict is... We're going to go with the defense. We're going to go with Tony. We believe that Kingdom of the Crystal Skull... can be considered in with the quality of the rest of the films. And I'll say this, okay? Kingdom of the Crystal Skull is not found innocent. It's found not guilty. But mainly because...
I agree.
Temple of Doom, especially on this rewatch, is so much worse than Raiders and Last Crusade. If this was in a trilogy and it was Last Crusade, Raiders and Kingdom, this would be an open and shut case against Kingdom. It's not up to the standard of Raiders and Last Crusade. I'd say it's a couple of notches below. But especially in this rewatch of Temple of Doom, if Short Round wasn't in Temple of Doom, I know he's a big part, it would be, in my view, actually not a very good film. There's some parts in there all right, but I think Temple of Doom is very weak. So on the basis that of the weakness of Temple of Doom, I think that just about means that this film can fit in with the franchise. But if this was just a trilogy and this was the third of the film, although the ending point, Tony, I like where you're coming from, this just does not cut the mustard with Last Crusade and Raiders. But I think it goes evenly fairly.
Not guilty, but I'm not off scot-free. Released for
just by a hair's breadth, as I said, just because of Temple of Doom. So that's my verdict, I'd say.
I will abide by that.
And of course, court of public opinion. We'll see what the world says. Yeah,
we're going to put this out on social media and things, and we're going to let the votes come in and whatnot, and we'll have people say what they did. I'm afraid I didn't check what the votes were on the prior Comics on Trial, so I should have done that. Sorry, friends. But yeah, so that's what the verdict is, I believe. You've done amazing points, lots of points I hadn't thought of, some points people have already made in the past, which have been developed a lot more. So really, really amazing. But for both of you.
Two things I just want to throw in as a final. This isn't a defender. This isn't a win. Yeah. This is actually just some indie facts about this. One thing neither of us mentioned, but I think is actually a belter in almost in all the films, the John Williams score.
Yes. Oh,
he's always the MVP.
Yeah, it's just phenomenal. So
George Lucas's career, not Spielberg's, but George Lucas's career is inextricably linked to Williams. And as much as we love Star Wars, that first Star Wars would almost be unwatchable without John Williams' score.
Okay.
Until Han Solo, until Carrie Fisher and Harrison Ford show up, it's unwatchable without John Williams. And then when they show up, you're like, oh, okay, stuff's going on. But honestly,
Indy's score is so iconic as well. As soon as you hear it, you're just excited. You've got that.
John Williams is the GOAT, man. I love that guy.
He is.
And the other thing that you just mentioned, Temple, don't forget as well, Temple was the reason or was the one of the major
PG-13? Yeah,
and the 12 for video and cinema. Sorry, for similar releases in the UK as well. So
I agree.
It is unwatchable without Key. Rewatching it, you're like, this kid is such a fucking star. And I know I've watched the behind the scenes stuff where Spielberg said, like, the card, like, you see Harrison Ford laughing during those scenes. That's real. Because he just said, Key, he's going to cheat. And I think it was like, Key's the one who stuffed him in his, like, that was all improv. Like, him, he's that good of an actor.
And he's
that,
my favorite character in Goonies. I love Data in Goonies is so cool. I love that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So I agree.
Yeah. So I agree. It's just, and it's not, I don't know what it is, if it's just that Kate Capshaw, it's weird. Like, I think it's weird that he cast his wife. And, like, so that whole time Harrison Ford's like, Steve.
Making out.
Yeah. I just feel
and
like
the
that's
sexual
weird...
stuff in it. I hate Indiana Jones. My least favorite thing is all the sexual stuff. You know, I'm not a prude by any stretch, but I just feel
it's
like
the bond.
Maybe
it's
the bond Marion stuff's okay, but in Temple of Doom, it's like, what is this? And then even in Last Crusade, it's a bit. Meh. They kind of make a joke about it with Sean Connery. So I like, because it makes the bond of Sean Connery, Henry Sr., him and Harrison Ford have such phenomenal chemistry in that film. And for me, Last Crusade works, and that romancey stuff, air quotes romance, it works because they twist it into like a kind of a joke.
Yeah.
And it's like being a bit, you know, being a bit laddish in a way, let's call it.
Yeah.
Not delving too deep in. But Temple of Doom, I just found, even the actress who played her says she's just a screaming blonde. And and she's not the actress herself, but the actual character is the worst part of Temple of Doom. It's
really
just culturally
so
inappropriate.
Terrible.
It's just awful in every way, and Short Round saves the movie. Without Short Round, I think Short Round for Temple does what John Williams does for Star Wars in a lot of ways.
What's funny though is at the time, whilst Kate Capshaw was absolutely ripped apart with the critics, one of the biggest things from the critics' point of view for Temple was, ugh, they've got a child sidekick.
He's amazing.
Outrageous.
He's great. Spectacular.
And I agree with the point.
Dr. Jones!
He was in this film. Like, I've got a problem with Shia LaBeouf, but I'd say, you know, my opinion of this film, it's fine. It's much better on the rewatch I had. But Shia LaBeouf, I ain't got a problem with, necessarily. You made the good point there, Scott, but like...
If
Short Round
was there,
if Short Round was in this film, this would be considered...
No one
would
have ever
Temple of
complained.
Doom would be the weak one, but you'd be like, but you've got to watch that one because Kingdom of the Crystal is so good with him growing up. And it would actually make the whole franchise stronger,
so
which
I'm
is
hoping,
frustrating.
I'm fingers crossed that they've kept it a secret and he shows up in the
film. I would love
one.
That.
Because they lie about stuff. People lie all the time.
Normally, if you're asked in an interview, like whenever Liam Neeson is about Star Wars or... Lars Mikkelsen of Styles as well. Literally anytime you have an interview come out which says, oh yeah, I'm definitely not in this film, I didn't get the call, it's almost guaranteed in a month or two they'll be announced in the thing.
Well, he was at the premiere, wasn't he?
Yeah, exactly. So,
fingers
crossed. But I will say as well, just one thing of my point with the atom bomb thing, although I think it's dumb, the Temple of Doom raft scene is insane.
Just as
it makes
bad
no
as
it,
this,
jumping out of a plane
bridge.
With a with an inflating raft and landing on water that's about this deep.
Well, they don't
and then
land
off
water.
How many?
No, they
then,
don't. But they don't land.
They land
water.
On a mountain.
Oh yeah, on the mountain top. Yeah, and then
yeah,
fall into the water.
No, they were covered in. Yeah, they've all broken all their bones.
Yeah, it just kind of. Oh, it floats.
No, to me, the fridge and the rafter.
Even when Megan saw the raft, bit, she was like, "What the hell is going on? This makes no sense at all." And it's like, you know, in that element, and I know is the waterfall bit, the constant waterfalls, that's in this film though, isn't
that's
it?
That's in this one, yeah.
Which if you'd have brought that up, that might have, because that waterfall bit is as stupid as the raft bit, I'd say, if not worse. Because like,
that's Fast and Furious, level.
But it's like,
ridiculous.
I didn't find the tree thing, I didn't find any more ridiculous than Temple, but the four or five waterfalls I thought was insane. But let's get on to plugs, because we're on a time limit. Scott, you go first. Tell people what they're up to. I'll put notes in the description and stuff, but please plug yourself in front of everyone.
Yeah, as you say, sort of go check out www.20thcenturygeek.com. There's all bits and pieces on there, but mainly the main podcast now is Stories Out of Time and Space, in which myself and good friend Julian Darius talk about sci-fi films every week, and we dissect them and go off on massive tangents. And we're also doing a trekking through the Twilight Zone, which is on there, so we're going through all the way through the Twilight Zone episodes, which has been really cool. And also, check out, I do write for the magazine High Strange. So just Google High Strange.
I'm a subscriber.
I'm actually writing. The reason I've been reading Chariots of the Gods is because I'm writing about the origins of the human species. So yeah, go check it out.
And amazing, Tony. Before I plug myself, I want to say to Scott, this week, Harrison Ford Legacy sequel came out this week. Yes. Blade Runner 2049 just came yes. out. So mm-hmm. it's all Harrison Ford all the time. Well, by the time this comes out, it'll have been 2 weeks
now
ago.
Now that's a legacy sequel he clearly, oh, you know. Yeah.
Love that.
He loved being in that one. There's nothing about that. Mm. So, and I think he had a fine time here. So thank you for this, guys. This is great. So my website's arfarina.com. You can get all my everything there. I've got Indie Comic Spotlight on this very network. It'll be, I have just been on yesterday. And then tomorrow, Mike will be on doing Star Wars Comics. It's a 3 day. It's us all 3 days, Mike. And obviously you can go and get my book, Welcome to Mansfield. You can get it to my website too, arfarina.com. Thank you guys for both supporting me and helping me out with that and being awesome. And no Mr. problem. Burton, where will people find you and your melodious voice? Mm.
Where will they find me indeed? Well, best place to keep up to date with us is the Pop Culture Collective, pccnewsletter.com. And we contribute to that, and it's got updates of what we're up to in general. But you can follow me on social media at Genuine Chit Chat on Instagram, Twitter, and on Facebook. You can also go to my YouTube channel. YouTube is probably the best way to find out everything I'm up to all the time, because everything is in playlists, all my episodes of Star Wars Comics and Canon, a lot of the collaborations I've done that I poached the video of and put them on here, like this one, and every episode of Genuine Chit Chat. And I've been doing a lot more video stuff of Genuine Chit Chat, making things look nice and fancy. And there's a Disney Discussions recent one on there that myself, Spider Dan, Rhea, and Megan do every now and then, which is fun, on Cartoon Crushes. So that's a really, really funny one. And yeah, George Mann, Star Wars author I spoke to. I spoke to a chap about college cartels. And then my 200th episode is probably going to be out with the week, because this is coming out next week of recording this. So yeah, 200th episode is going to be out a couple of days after this. So get it. If you haven't already, by listening to this, get any questions, send them over, and I'll read them aloud on air. And that'll be all good fun. I didn't realize I was going to be promoting my 200th episode on this, but I did. And it's also my 300th release on the feed of Genuine Chit Chat, because of part ones and part twos. So I've been doing it for, and it's almost my 6 year anniversary. So all culminating.
Congratulations.
All together. Wow. On podcasting.
And we all agree it's okay. And so does Indy. It's okay to punch a Nazi.
Yes. Yes. Go back to listen to the first ever episode where the intros are ridiculously long, even longer than this outro. But friends, thank you so much for listening to Comics in Motion, or if you're watching the video version on my YouTube channel, thank you for letting me selfishly poach that view. We appreciate each and every one of you. Check out Tony's stuff, check out Scott's stuff. They're all incredible. Links will be in the description to all our amazing things. Subscribe to the feed of Comics in Motion to get all your comics and comic adjacent content and everything else that you could ever want from a podcast. And obviously, check out Stories at a Time in Space, because you get conversations on there unlike any other. Deep dives so into good. Sci-fi content. It doesn't even do it justice calling it a deep dive. It's like a subatomic dive into the Mariana Trench. double dive. That's how insane this is. But friends, thank you so much for joining us. Scott and Tony, great
thank
job
you guys.
On this. It was an amazing Comics on Trial. Appreciate you both. And we will speak to all of you listeners at some point in the future, maybe with another Comics on Trial. So subscribe and you won't miss it. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Court adjourned.